You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Bickert. So according to a Scholastic survey, about half of parents feel their children don't spend enough time reading books for fun. The report also found that 33% of parents say their children spend too much time playing video or computer games. Now, I would completely like to get on board with this and encourage children to love reading. On the other hand, I know that I was a video game nerd when I was a kid. So it's interesting to think about where the line is. And Rob, you played video games. Well, why am I using the past tense? You play video games and you read.
We had the Atari 2600 when I was a kid. I went to play at the arcade at the little mini golf course in Ann Arbor. But I read a lot, too. Like, I had a lot of time for video games. I read. I guess I didn't get much exercise is what I lost there.
But so clearly, if you use the two of us as evidence, there's overlap between video games and people who like to read.
Right. And I learned a lot from video games, like Space Invaders
and
Defender, that no matter how hard you try, they're going to get you.
I learned how to make burgers.
Burger Time. You're a big Burger Time fan.
Well, our next guest is a former video game geek and also a reader and writer. Christopher John Farley is a senior editor at the Wall Street Journal, where he just wrote a piece about how books could learn a thing or two from video games. He's the author of the book Game World. Christopher, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. You know, I don't know if you're ever a former video game geek. I think I continue to be one and I will be one for life.
You never put it behind you.
I think that's exactly right.
Well, so you're like a lot of parents out there. You want your kids to love to read, which is it makes sense. You're an author. But you also worry that they're playing too many video games. Why do parents tend to pit video games and reading against each other?
Well, that's a good observation. You know, part of the problem today is back when we were kids, video games weren't as immersive. You know, going way back, you put your two quarters in and the video game lasts a few minutes and you're done. Now the video games are obviously at home. They're fully immersive, the graphics are better, the storylines are more involving. Maybe they're playing them online with friends as well. And they can really completely take over their entire world and not leave any room for reading or for books or for literature. But my feeling is the two things don't necessarily have to be pitted against one another, and one can be used to reinforce doing the other. Particularly video games can be used in certain ways to get kids to read more, to want to read more, to pick up a book, so they can fill out other parts of their personality that they can't by just, you know, tooling around Grand Theft Auto.
Well, are there things that book culture and writers could learn from those immersive video games that you're talking about?
Well, I think number one is that reading, you know, like gaming, really can be a social exercise. You know, games have gotten much more social just in the last few years and months, with kids being able to play online, interacting with other friends from school, strictly through the whole world of the video game. And that pulls people in. It makes video games a platform for other kinds of discussions and pushes other things out. But I think if you try to turn books into a more social thing, that can get kids to read too. For example, one thing I've found really helps getting my kids to read is if they form their own sort of smaller book clubs with friends, because then reading becomes more of an interactive thing. Their friend is reading a book, they're reading the same book, they can discuss it. It's a simple thing, it's an intuitive thing, it may be an obvious thing, but it really works.
That's interesting. I haven't heard about too many kid book clubs. I know that ever since Oprah, every, you know, woman I know is in a book club, not as many guys, but it's interesting to think about the concept of kids' book clubs.
Yeah, my son formed a small book club over the summer just with another friend. They finished two books, but they had a ball reading those two books. They are both totally into it. We threw a party each time they finished a book and so they could discuss the book together. And it really got them involved in the very meat of the book because they knew the other kid was reading too. And they kind of wanted to impress each other about the depth of their knowledge about what they're reading. The other thing I've been doing lately too is just talking to his friends about what they're reading and what really excites them. And some of the answers are kind of surprising, like a friend of his read The Outsiders and just loved the book and just totally involved in it. So I thought, maybe I get my son The Outsiders, he'll love it too. And he did. He connected with this decades-old story. So I guess that story really works. I never would have bought The Outsiders on my own for my son, but because another kid on his basketball team recommended it, it turned out it worked for him. Still connects to young boys.
Let's talk about the content a little more. Is part of the problem maybe that we want them reading Tolstoy in fifth grade or something like that when we might be better off, I don't know, getting a novelized tie-in to those video games that they're playing?
Yeah, my son keeps asking to read War and Peace. I guess I should probably get him a copy of it.
War and Peace, the video game.
I'm not joking. He wants to read it. I'm like,
really?
Well, I don't know if you're quite ready for that because you're laughing, but I'll get it for him if you want.
I didn't even make it through War and Peace, and I have tried. That's impressive that your son is so interested.
But I think it is important that books be fun. So, you know, when my son wants to read comic books, I go to the comic book store with him all the time because as long as he's reading, I think it's a good thing. So he'll go there and he'll get the Avengers, he'll get the Simpsons comics, he'll get newer graphic novels as well. You know, as long as they're sitting there, they're reading, they're inside their own heads, they're interacting with the page, the written word, that gets them involved in the world of books. So I think parents shouldn't be snobs about it and go like, well, why are they reading Diary of a Wimpy Kid? No, if they're reading, if they're turning the pages, they're moving in the right direction. So don't turn that off. If they're doing it, it's good.
Now, when Rob and I were playing video games, it was Galaga was my game in Burger Time. What was yours? Joust or something?
Joust, yeah. Galaga 2, yeah.
Okay, so those were not, if you remember, the graphics. Those were just like little blobs on the screen moving around. Now the video games, they are so fleshed out and interesting and rich.
And more plots, too.
More plots, and it's what you call, Christopher, world building. What can books learn about world building from video games?
Well, I think some of those old-time games are now acknowledged classics. They're like modern art now. You look at them, Pac-Man, you're like, that's perfect. Don't change a thing. Pong, that's what it's all about. But, of course, now games have richer graphics, more involved worlds. And I think that you should do the same thing with books. You've got to make sure people understand there's a whole world there for them to explore. So one thing I do with my kids is I take them to children's bookstores, not just the big chain bookstores, though they have their place too. I take them to kids' bookstores where there are events happening, where there are interested salespeople who can actually show them around and say, hey, this book is good, or here's what you might like this because you like that. And if you actually have a real person there telling them about author events, telling them about readings that are taking place, telling them about treasure hunts that are happening in the store, all those things lead them to see, oh, there's a world here of books, just like there's a world of video games, and there's something that I can explore as well. It's part of building a culture around reading. And I've done it with my own kids. It really does work. It is a very effective tool in getting kids to really sort of love reading.
How important is modeling if we're telling kids read more, but we're always playing a game on our smartphone versus we're telling them to read more and we're reading in front of them? Does that make a difference?
You know, you're so right. And if you're sitting there smoking, of course your kid might take up smoking. No matter how much you say smoking is bad for you, the same thing in a good way with books. If you're reading a book, your kid is much more likely to read a book too. That's one reason why I wrote, you know, this kid's book, Game World, is that, you know, I saw my son wasn't involved in reading as I might have wanted him to be. So I wrote a book that I thought would get him excited about reading because it got me excited about writing. And I also made sure he saw me around the house writing this book, reading other books. And it really shows him, hey, if Dad is doing it, if Dad is really enjoying reading books, writing books, world building, you know, maybe something that I can get involved in too. So over the summer, one thing we did is on Sundays, we'd spend an hour or so, and we'd just all sit around the TV room. All the screens in the house would have to be off, and we'd sit around, and we'd all have a book to read. Mom would join in, too, my wife, and we'd just all have our own books, whether they were comic books, whether they were big books, whether they were silly, trashy books. We were just all reading as a family, sitting down, all the screens off. And I tell you, those were some of the best times we had this summer, and my kids would agree.
Family reading time. That's another great one. You also mentioned maybe using video games as kind of a bribe for reading. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I'm not above bribing kids. I'm totally down with that. I bribe my kids to read all the time, and it actually works. I'll say, hey, listen, you read 5 books, I'll buy you that pair of sneakers. I've done it. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm going to admit it to all your readers. I've done it, and it works. Because I want to make sure the kids are reading for whatever reason. Because if they're reading great books, after a while, they'll have to read them without the bribes. But so I have put bribes on the table to get them to read. There's no screens during the week except for on special occasions. So the end of the week feels special when they get to turn the TV off, when they get home on a Friday after school. They all rush and turn on the TV, and they watch TV for a while. They play video games for a while, but it should be on special occasions. Try to keep it within certain boundaries, because those video games, they're really like a drug. They can take over people's entire lives. I know, because I've done it. I remember one time I got this one video game that was so involving. I was up all night playing, and my wife came up and said, "What are you doing? It's 2 a.m. I just lost track of time in this video game." So if you can do that to an adult, right, I'm sure I can do that to kids much more easily.
Well, Christopher, interesting ideas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Christopher John Farley is a senior editor at The Wall Street Journal, where he recently wrote a piece about what books can learn from video games. He's also the author of the book Game World.
Coming up, a new report rounds up the state of Wisconsin agriculture, and it looks like there's good news for the bottom line. First, here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll get a peek into the sea caves on Lake Superior.
First, we take a look at the state of agriculture in Wisconsin. And it turns out the findings are pretty good.
According to a new report, Wisconsin farmers hit near record incomes in 2013. A lot of that has to do with a revitalized dairy industry.
We're joined now by the editor of that report, Ed Jesse. He's also a professor emeritus of agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
In general, how's Wisconsin agriculture doing?
Very well. We've had three very good years with net farm income above $3 billion. In 2013, we estimate that Wisconsin farmers earned about $3.75 billion, and that compares with the record high in 2011 of 3.8 and over 3.2 in 2012. So, three very good years, and I think that's been very beneficial in allowing farmers to pay off some debts and to invest in some new equipment.
It's interesting about the three good years, especially considering the wild weather that we've had over the last year at least. Was this a surprise finding?
Well, not really. When you have a drought situation, you have much lower supplies and much higher prices. As a result, the crop side of the ledger did very, very well in 2012. Despite a bad crop, the prices were high enough to offset that, and those farmers did very well. In contrast, in 2013, a good year for crops, the very large supplies drove prices down, and actually farmers ended up worse than they did on the grain side than 2012.
Now, what is it that accounts for these three good years? Is it mainly just the prices?
Basically, prices along with production. In the case of dairy, which is our largest commodity sector, we had record gross income in 2013 because of prices that were second to the record price, and production that was about 1.5% above last year. So that combination yielded about $5.6 billion to dairy farmers on the gross side. Of course, abstracting from the higher cost, that left net revenues somewhat less, but nevertheless a record high on the gross income side.
Now, you mentioned the dairy industry, and it sounds like there was a big rebound there. So let's talk about that. What was behind the rebound for the dairy industry?
Well, if we go back to 2004, we had lost about 3 billion pounds of production from our peak year in 1988. And beginning in 2005, we began a major revitalization with milk production increasing between 400 and 700 million pounds a year. In 2013, we'll produce very close to 28 billion pounds of milk in Wisconsin compared to the 22 billion that we produced in 2004. The reason for this is a very concerted, almost well-organized effort on the part of many entities in Wisconsin to try and revitalize the industry, realizing that the dairy industry was of great value to the state. They were losing infrastructure as this milk production decline occurred. And a combination of state efforts, farm organization efforts, university efforts to bring about the change. And it occurred, once it occurred, very rapidly.
Now, I know for a while, and it's still going on, as far as I know, Wisconsin is going sort of head-to-head with California over cheese production. Do you have any sense about where Wisconsin is on cheese production these days?
Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, we were concerned that California would overtake Wisconsin in cheese production, as it did in milk production back in 1993. That did not happen for a number of reasons. First of all, California began to divert more of its milk into exportable products such as non-fat dried milk, and Wisconsin continued to go full speed ahead on production of cheese, and we're currently well ahead of California in terms of cheese production.
Really? Okay, good for us. Well, what about livestock and crop producers?
Livestock producers did well in 2013 in general. Beef supply, the fed beef supply, was shortened because of very high feed prices, and beef prices were higher, pork prices were higher, broiler prices were somewhat higher, and turkey prices as well. So livestock producers in general did quite well, not record in the same sense as dairy, but still quite well.
And we've got a caller here that let's go ahead and take. Matt is joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I get concerned whenever I hear about how great Wisconsin agriculture is doing by looking just at that bottom line total production number. I live in a rural area. I'm a part-time farmer myself. And what I see happening is California-style mega dairies coming in and driving out family-scale farms. And I see more and more acres of pasture and other erodible land going into corn and soybean production. So while these record profits are being made, I think our sustainability and for the environment and our water quality and our air quality are taking a significant hit. And I think it's something we need to be very concerned about.
All right. Well, thank you for those thoughts, Matt. I appreciate you calling in. And Ed, what would you say to that? Should we be concerned about sustainability as we take into stock how Wisconsin is doing?
I think Matt makes some excellent points. I think that's a concern of many. But I would say that, surprising to me at least, the attrition in dairy farms in Wisconsin has actually slowed down greatly. We've seen, Matt's absolutely right, a modernization, a growth in the larger dairy operations. But at the same time, we've seen more attention to value-added products on the part of grazers. We've seen a big increase in organic milk production. And these enterprises, grazers and organic, who are the same organic means grazing, they're smaller than the typical operation and doing very well. And they're not losing speed in the sense of going out of business. So I'm pleased by that. I think it offsets some of the concerns about the mega farms. We do have mega farms in dairy in Wisconsin. But at the same time, we have a very healthy, smaller segment of the industry.
Now, at least in the food scene here in Wisconsin and beyond, there is a very strong farm-to-table movement going on, an emphasis on local food, sustainable foods. Do you see that having an impact in Wisconsin's agriculture?
I think so. Obviously, these movements that you mentioned are important in terms of increasing demand for local production. But at the same time, I'd say that we can't rely on Wisconsin to absorb all of our cheese. We make a huge amount of it, and most of it leaves the state. So I guess I do get concerned a little bit about focusing on products for which we may not have a comparative advantage relative to other states, and the cost of going to an increasingly local food supply. I think we need to recognize that we don't grow very good oranges in Wisconsin, and it's hard to produce milk in Florida.
I know it's still early, but what do you think about 2014 coming up? Do you expect that to be another good year for Wisconsin farmers?
Well, the crystal ball is pretty murky, but I think it's safe to say that we will not do as well in 2014 as we did in 2013. We're seeing some good profits in dairying right now that are going to lead to an expansion in production, and that is going to have an effect on price ultimately. We're seeing a recovery in milk production in the European Union and in New Zealand, our major export competitors. So I think that that our exports will be down in 2014 from where they were last year. I think that livestock producers will do fairly well, because prices are not going to drop much and feed will be a lot cheaper. The ones that will take the biggest hits are probably grain farmers, grain and soybean farmers. We expect much lower prices in 2014 for those folks, and that's coming after several years of very good prices, particularly for corn.
Ed, thank you so much for being on and talking agriculture with us today.
You're quite welcome.
Ed Jesse is a professor emeritus of agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the Lake Superior Sea Caves. It's the first time in 5 years they've been open to pedestrian traffic on the frozen lake. We'll get a sneak peek inside. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later on the show, we'll talk with a guest who says we should test students more, not less.
First, you might have heard about the Lake Superior Sea Caves this week. After 5 years of being closed, the weather is finally cold enough to freeze Lake Superior enough to allow people, I guess, to walk to the caves.
Here to tell us more about the caves is Bob Krummenacker, the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore Superintendent. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Glad to be here.
So people are really liking this ice cave story. It's gone gangbusters on our website, and it's got us curious. Tell us about these ice caves. What are they?
Well, first of all, it's gone gangbusters all over the world. We've got reports that some media in Australia is covering this, and
wow.
I've got friends in Arizona who've seen stories about it, so it really is a pretty remarkable thing.
That's incredible.
The ice caves of the Apostle Islands are very possibly the most unique thing in this national park. And as any Wisconsin resident knows, this is one of the coolest places in national park in the state of Wisconsin in the summer. But the caves are a very rare phenomenon. These are also the most popular place for people to kayak in the summertime in the park. They are on a sandstone ridge that forms the shoreline of Lake Superior. It's on the mainland, not on one of the islands. And in the summertime, it's about a half an hour to an hour kayak from the Myers Beach parking area, and as I said, very popular. But when Lake Superior freezes over, doesn't have to freeze entirely, but when it freezes very solidly in this vicinity, which is becoming increasingly rare, then it is possible when the conditions are ripe for people to be able to walk from that same parking area along the shoreline, on the beach, and then on the ice itself, and walk up to the caves, and then walk into the caves, as a matter of fact.
So how long a hike is that, and do you need snowshoes?
It's a little over a mile in each direction, and generally snowshoes are not necessary, although if people have the little ones, the kind that maybe are about 2 feet long, that if they found they weren't very useful, they could put in a pack on their back, they might be worth taking along, particularly if there's been some recent snow. And one thing that's very interesting here this winter is that this has been a very big snow year and a very big ice year, and those things don't always go together.
Oh, interesting. Well, for people who haven't been out to see them, and I gather the weather is quite cold up there right now, but can you describe them for us?
Well, you're first of all, walking on frozen Lake Superior in itself is a treat. It scares the heck out of some people, and others just find it incredibly neat. But when you think about this big lake out there, and you're on a solid surface that's at least 9 inches thick. We make sure it is before we will open the caves, but usually it's thicker than that. But every once in a while, you walk and you realize that the surface is moving a little bit, and the water is actually underneath there, and the waves are still going.
Wow.
So it's a slightly undulating surface, and sometimes you'll be going along and you'll hear a crack, and you look around and hope that the ice is not breaking up, and thus far, every time I've gone out there, that has not happened.
Wait, Lee Bob, you're sure this is safe? You're describing cracks and undulation to me.
Well,
this is safe,
I
right?
I want to put it in context. Actually, the National Park Service never uses the word safe. What we do is we try to provide all the information, and then we stop saying it's unsafe, to be honest. Do it at your own risk. I mean, we on weekends have trained park rangers who are available to assist and would be there if there were an emergency. And we had about 4,000 people over the weekend, and thankfully there were no injuries. But it is the sort of thing that you need to realize you're going out in these very challenging conditions. It can be difficult walking. And so even though the snowshoes are not necessary, certainly very heavy boots, Sorels or some other kind of pack boot, and dressing for the weather, because it's cold out there and it's windy sometimes. So I want to make sure people know what they're getting into. This is not a trip for the casual or the unhealthy or pets that are off leash or elderly or five-year-olds, unless they're capable of doing it, and those that need help will get that help. But once you're out there, once you actually are able to get out there and get past all the warnings that the National Park Service gives you, what you'll find is cave-like formations. If you've ever been to Carlsbad Caverns or any of the great caves around the United States, you know that there are features that hang down. In that case, it's limestone. They're called stalactites, and they come in a whole variety of different shapes and sizes. And basically, we've got exactly the same kind of formation happening, except it's happening out of ice, and therefore it's a whole quick thing, and it's ephemeral, and it might be different from day to day. But there are places out there where you have curtains of ice that look like you're in some Victorian-type theater that are very thick and rolling and massive. And then particularly because it's been so cold of late, there are incredibly fine, delicate crystals that look like maybe large snow crystals that are growing. And then you have these things hanging down. And it's an amazing fairyland of features out there. And very fragile, of course. We ask that people not touch them because they'll break, of course, and they only last a few days or a few weeks at most.
Wow, well, it sounds pretty magical, and it looks pretty magical from what I've seen on the Wisconsin Public Radio website. If you've got enough Yeti in you to make the hike out to the ice caves, how many people have done that so far?
Well, we had about 2,000 people a day on Saturday and Sunday last week. We had just opened it up a few days earlier. During the week this week, if there were 100 people a day, that would be a lot. So the real nice time to come, if people are able to do it, would be on a weekday, not a weekend. What we found is that our parking area is absolutely overwhelmed on the weekend. And actually, Saturday and Sunday were probably the busiest days in the history of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, winter or summer.
That's incredible.
It is incredible. And we've never seen anything like this. And frankly, since it's been 5 years since the caves have been open, I think that's part of it. But if people can brave the weather, they'll have a very unique experience.
So it's been 5 years since the caves were open. Is that just because Lake Superior didn't have enough ice depth at that point? It wasn't frozen enough?
It wasn't frozen enough. And this is very definitely consistent with all of the climate change projections, as well as the history of ice cover over the last several decades on Lake Superior. So this park is also known as one of the places that is really in the forefront of climate change education and adaptation. And so we are referring to this really as an endangered national park experience, because our grandchildren may not get this opportunity, or certainly wouldn't get this opportunity very often.
Well, given all of that, I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in checking out the sea caves that are now ice caves. But we have another, it looks to me like another polar vortex-y thing kind of coming our way next week. And I imagine it'll be colder along Lake Superior. Should people brave it? Can they? Or do you think they should wait for warmer temperatures? What's your advisory, advice there?
Well, that's a hard one. You know, I can't predict that they'll even be there tomorrow to go out to, although the odds are pretty good of that. So I think people should really ask themselves, do I want to be out in a place that's very far from help in these conditions? And if the answer is that's pretty risky, I don't feel comfortable doing it, I would wait for better conditions. So this weekend will be cold. I think it looks very likely that we'll have these caves for several weeks. Normally, in years that the caves form, they don't even the ice doesn't form well enough until mid-February. So we're very, very early. Of course, we don't know how long winter will last and whether we'll stay this cold, but it's also very possible that this is the longest ice cave season that we've ever had as well. So I think if people use good sense rather than braving the elements when it's just silly to be outside. If it's 0 degrees and 20-mile-an-hour winds, I don't recommend that to anybody, no matter what they're looking at.
Now, as superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, you're familiar with the lake and what it can do. How does this compare to the other wonders of the lake? How cool is it?
There are a lot of very cool places on Lake Superior, and I've, in addition to working here, I spent 6 years working at Isle Royale National Park earlier in my career, and that's a spectacular place as well. And we all know the North Shore and the Canadian Shore. There are great places in the Picture Rocks in Michigan. I think they're all complementary. They're all part of a big whole, but to the best of my knowledge, there is nowhere else on this lake and possibly anywhere in the world where you can have this particular experience. So I'd say get this experience and then get as many other Lake Superior experiences as you can as well.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Bob, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
You're welcome, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Bob Krummenacker, the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore Superintendent.
Coming up next, we'll talk with a guest who makes the case that kids actually need more testing in schools, not less.
But first, here's a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up next hour, our guest takes us on a tour through the age of anxiety. But first, testing in schools has gotten a bad rap among some education pundits. Their critique, it drags down morale for students and teachers, and it's bad for learning.
But our next guest reports that testing, done the right way, can improve comprehension and memory retention and help teachers make sure kids understand what they're learning. The crux, according to some researchers, we could maybe use more testing, not less. Jessica Leahy joins us now. She writes about teaching and parenting for The Atlantic and The New York Times. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, frequent testing in schools has gotten a bad rep for some people studying education and education policy. Why do you think that is?
Well, rightly so. I mean, I think that testing, the large standardized testing that's it's called summative testing. It's looking at a snapshot of what students can do and maybe what teachers are doing and what schools have done. It's a kind of testing that, you know, puts a big burden on schools in terms of time. It takes time away from the classroom. And that's definitely not the kind of testing that I was talking about in the article in encouraging more testing.
So the research that you write about is showing that certain kinds of testing can have a big upside. First, as you just mentioned, it's a particular kind of testing. What works according to this research?
As opposed to summative testing, which is, you know, you get to the end of a unit and you look to see what the students have learned or hopefully have learned. This is called formative testing, and this is testing that you do in order to find out where the gaps are, maybe as a teacher, where you need to go next in order to double back, in order to clarify. It takes a lot more work on the teacher's part, and it takes flexibility. But the research of Dr. Roediger at Washington University has shown that this kind of testing actually improves memory and learning because the act of calling up those things that you have hopefully learned, and even trying to grasp around for the things that you haven't quite learned yet, will reinforce the memories in your brain much better than testing once at the end or studying more.
So I'm a student, and I've just finished a unit on, say, long division. I get a test. It shows that I don't understand it, and then we move on to decimal points or something like that. So
right.
the argument is, A, there's no room to fix what I didn't know because we were already moving on, and B, that wasn't necessarily the best way to evaluate me in the first place.
Absolutely, and learning is cumulative. I mean, the nice thing about learning is that as long as you have hooks or as long as you have sticky places in your memory to hang the new bits of information, you know, learning is pretty much unlimited. You can learn as much as you want as long as you have a framework to hang it on. But in algebra, for example, if you never learned how to use the quadratic formula, then moving on to the next unit is going to be a big problem for you because you don't have that knowledge to hang the new stuff on.
So that would foil our efforts to learn quadratic equations. Math joke, sorry. So are schools trying to implement these different kinds of testing, or is this research just kind of out there and not being used?
Well, after I wrote the piece in The Atlantic, many teachers commented that they said, well, duh, we knew that. And I said, well, you know, I commented back to one, actually, and I said, well, many teachers understand that assessment of kids or testing kids is a process that you do. We check in with our students every day. We check to make sure, you know, that they're doing well at home. And all those little check-ins on the knowledge as we're going through the class every single day is part of this formative assessment. But the problem is that people misunderstand and think, oh, tests equal bad, because we're hearing so much in the news about testing being negative for schools, negative for students. I was just interested in the distinction between testing with a capital T, the standardized testing, and this process of the informal formative assessments that teachers do every single day, and making it clear that those are actually really great. Quizzes are fantastic. You know, smaller tests on a more frequent basis are really great for learning. Those large summative tests, maybe not so much.
So the science is saying you've read it, you've done the lessons, maybe you've done some drills if we're talking about math or mm-hmm. spelling, but it actually helps our brain to be tested on it and try to recall, maybe not in a high-stakes environment, with a low-stress environment. It helps our brains to access it, and then when we access it, we're more prone to remember it?
Absolutely, and it turns out that in Dr. Roediger's research, he also found that if you get tested on something, you're a lot less likely to lose that short-term memory information. It turns out that cramming, shoving things into your short-term memory, and trying to get through the test the next day, it works on a limited basis, but the problem is that you forget it promptly, because when you shove all that stuff in your short-term memory, you're not really solidifying it in memory. So if you do a few quizzes, or you do some flashcards, or you have your parent quiz you, that information, the process of retrieving what's sitting there in your short-term memory, is going to actually work to solidify it in longer-term memory.
Let's talk about maybe some benefits of the other kinds of testing that's getting a bad rap. At the end of a semester, at the end of a school year, part of what the school wants to know is Rob ready to move on to the next grade? Isn't there some value in that kind of end-of-the-year testing?
We're talking about a spectrum here. If I do, for example, in my Latin class, if I do a test at the end of the semester or the end of the term or the end of the unit to find out if you've learned the 25 vocabulary words I asked you to learn last week, that's one thing. But the large standardized tests that are being given, you know, administered by states, what you're asking those tests to do is to look at a school's effectiveness or a teacher's effectiveness over a huge amount of material in a very, very small format, even though those tests feel, you know, incredibly long, really in terms of what you're trying to test, it's a very small sampling. So when I'm talking about tests being bad, I'm not talking about like the unit tests or the semester tests that a teacher gives you. I'm talking about the standardized tests that are really trying to pit one school against the other or gauge how a school's effectiveness as a learning institution.
Seems like there's a fundamental philosophical question here. Is a test a tool for evaluation, or is a test a tool for learning?
Well, a lot of teachers, that one of the other big issues with the article was that, you know, some teachers are saying, well, testing is really besides the point. If we're really testing for mastery, what we should be asking students to do is actively demonstrate knowledge. And again, back to Dr. Roediger's research, he found that, you know, a multiple choice test actually, you know, has some limited ability to help you remember things, but what's really great is something like an essay. If you have to write about what you learned, if you have to spell it out in words and re-explain it, as any teacher will tell you, the way to really learn something is to teach it to someone else. A method I use a lot in my classroom, because in order to be able to teach it to someone else, you have to know it backwards and forwards and be able to recall and think of it in new ways. So, you know, that idea of an essay or reteaching it, you know, grab a little sibling and teach them about, you know, some moment in history that you have to learn for your history class. That would be the best way to get prepared for a test.
You touched on this briefly earlier, but as you're talking, the word that keeps popping into my head is workload. It's very easy to take a fill-in-the-bubble Scantron test, run it through the machine, and get the grade.
Yep.
All these things sound more time-consuming. Are schools, do they have the resources, the person power to do this?
I think, as I mentioned before, formative teaching is a teaching to what your students know and being flexible for the future. It does take more time. It takes more planning, and it takes, like I said, a lot more flexibility. And when we're, you know, having a curriculum put on a teacher, say, you have to teach everything in this curriculum in this very limited period of time, yeah, that's a lot to ask for a teacher. But for a teacher that values teaching to mastery, it really is the best way to go. And if you look at the studies, actually teaching this way, you can get a lot more done because you're not having to constantly go back and say, oh, man, we did that 4 weeks ago. I really have to go over that again for you and take all that time out of class to redo what should have been done right in the first place.
Who would have to take the lead on this? It could come from the schools, I guess, but there are federal and state mandates requiring the standardized testing. That's mm-hmm. taking some of the time away that might be used for the learning type testing that we're talking about. Who do we look to make a change like this?
Well, I think part of it has to happen in teacher training. If you know, Dr. Roediger's research, he has a book coming out in April, actually, called Make It Stick, that really is a culmination of a lot of his research. That kind of information, if that's conveyed to teachers early on and teachers can understand that this process is really more effective than trying to do a big net and hope that you get all the kids the first time around, that is really going to help new teachers get out there knowing how to get at this the right way and how to teach the right way in a formative way instead of a summative way and then having to repeat all your efforts when you miss a few kids, because you always do, because every kid is different.
Right. But again, the teachers have some room for initiative here. The schools do, but they're working in these federal guidelines. Do they have room to do this, given that they've got to prepare for the state and national educational tests and, to some extent, teach to those tests for the good of their schools?
Well, I think you can still teach to those tests, but you can do that in a way that is more effective in the teaching phase, in the phase of, okay, we're going to talk about X today, and then at the end of that class, give a little quick 5-minute quiz on X. What did we learn today? Write down, give me a paragraph about the most important things you think we learned today. It takes 5 minutes at the end of each class, and it's a really good way to sort of get that short-term memory to a place where it's going to stick a little bit longer.
You mentioned some of the reaction to your article was in the duh camp. Some people are already doing this. What else have you heard? Are people saying, I love this idea, I hate this idea? What kind of things are you hearing?
I think the nice thing about it with some teachers is that they say, yes, this is what I've been doing, but I didn't have really words to put to it, either because they weren't really taught about this sort of assessment in the first place, or it's just something that some really good teachers can do naturally. It just kind of makes sense once you start doing it. The feedback has been really fantastic. There's been a lot of administrators who have taken this article into their teacher meetings this week and said, you know, let's think about this, because one of the functions of the weekly teacher meeting is to get people thinking about ways to teach better. And that's one of the great things about, you know, my job, is I get to research ideas and put them out there and hopefully start some discussion on them just like this.
Any thoughts from parents in the reaction you've heard?
You know what? The parents have also been really supportive, because one of the things that they're now able to do is say, okay, well, let's do flashcards instead of sending my kid off to his room and rereading that French chapter 3 times, because that's the way students usually do it. And in fact, in this research, that was the control, is they had students just reread and reread and reread the same material over and over again. And why would you want to spend 2 hours doing that when you could have a much more effective 20-minute flashcard session? It really could save a lot of time for students in the end.
Jessica, thanks so much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
That's Jessica Leahy. She covers teaching and parenting for The Atlantic, where she just wrote a piece about the role of testing in schools.
Coming up next, a writer comes clean about what it's like living with anxiety in his search for peace of mind. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.